This is Mark Strassman, reporter with California Politics Today. We're about to speak to Elizabeth Poirier, who is a state representative in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, who's written an article about the sources of eggs for stem cell research, and she's going to talk to us about that today. Welcome to California Politics Today.
Thank you, Mark. I'm delighted to be with you.
Why don't you tell us what area of Massachusetts you represent so that people in California and elsewhere whose cognitive map doesn't include much more of Massachusetts than Boston can know where you are.
Okay, I'll be happy to. It's known as the 14th Bristol District.
Right.
And my home is in the town of North Attleboro, which is about 40 miles south of Boston.
Okay.
On Route 95, which everyone knows. And I represent all of North Attleboro and parts of the city of Attleboro, the town of Mansfield, and the town of Norton. It's about 40,000 people.
Okay. Now, tell us, if you can briefly, what the situation is with stem cell research in Massachusetts, in particular, what's happening politically in the legislature and with the governor, and where things stand now on that issue.
Okay, I'll be happy to. Well, for us in the legislature, we were sworn in early in January, and we have a brand new Speaker of the House and a second-term President of the Senate. The Speaker of the House has appointed many new chairmen of committees, so the legislature has gotten off to a very, very slow start this year, with everyone kind of getting settled in their new roles.
Before we go further, what's the Democratic-Republican split there?
Oh, it's very interesting. There are 21 Republicans in the House of 160. So there's 139 Democrats.
That's pretty lopsided Democratic.
Sure is.
And how about the governor?
In the Senate, there are 40 members. There are 6 Republicans and 34 Democrats. Mm-hmm. And we have a Republican governor, Mitt Romney, who I'm sure everyone knows.
Right.
And he is the 4th Republican governor we've had in succession.
Without wanting to get into too much of the details, which I'm sure is infinitely fascinating.
It is.
How do you have such a lopsidedly Democratic legislature and a Republican governor?
Well, as you know, Massachusetts has been considered a very liberal state, and
right.
In fact is for many, many years.
Right.
And I don't know whether the people, the voters, have decided that this is some kind of a balance having a Republican governor.
Right.
Quite frankly, in my view, the Democratic candidates who have run for governor were very, very weak.
Right.
The last several, and so the Republican was clearly the proper choice to put in that role.
Okay, and you yourself are a Republican.
Yeah, okay. Part of the feisty minority.
All right. So we've got the stage set here now. Let's see who some of the main actors are.
Well, the president of the Senate,
right.
Robert Travaglini, had decided early on that this was going to be a piece that he was going to put through. It was going to be the first thing done, and he had declared early on that this would pass overwhelmingly, and it would be on the governor's desk for signature at the end of March.
Right.
So,
if we go back one more step, there are great research universities there in Massachusetts.
Yes, there are.
And a lot of biotech companies. And I'm wondering what you could say about the relationship between the great research universities, the biotech companies, and the agenda of the legislature on stem cells.
Well, it's all very interesting because our former Speaker of the House, whose name was Thomas Finneran,
right.
was a very, very strong speaker, and he left last year to take the president of the Biotech Council's job.
No.
He, during his term, was a very strong opponent of particularly of embryonic stem cell research,
right.
and has prevented it from coming to the floor.
Right.
But with this change in leadership, the President of the Senate made this the focal point of his year, this year. This was the thing he was going to accomplish.
Okay, again, there's so much of interest here. I want to pursue just a little bit. You're saying
sure.
the Speaker of the House of Representatives was an adamant opponent of
yes.
embryonic stem cell research.
Yes, he was.
And then he took a job as head of the Biotech Council.
Yeah. Isn't that interesting?
Did he change his position?
Well, he claims no. He claims that he is not. He also claims that as far as the biotech industry goes,
right.
that this is a very extremely minute portion of what they do, and that they really are not that concerned about it. As far as the workforce in Massachusetts goes,
right.
1% of our workforce is in biotech, and
right.
1% of the 1% is in stem cell.
Oh, okay.
So it's very minute.
So that,
however,
so, yeah.
I think the politics of it is this. MIT is the forerunner in this area.
Right.
And I believe Harvard has missed the boat.
Right.
And so in their attempt to catch up,
right,
the president of the Senate represents Harvard.
Who's the president of the Senate?
Travellini.
Oh, right, okay.
He represents Cambridge.
Right.
And so they are part of his district. And
Is MIT also part of his district?
No, it isn't. Harvard is.
Who's the senator from MIT?
I can't tell you that right now.
But Travellini, who's the president of the Senate, is from Harvard.
Yeah, and he's
okay.
The only one that counts.
Right.
And so everyone is trying to figure out what is driving the president to push this forward. He's
right.
made this the only issue, and the skids have been greased since the beginning of the year.
Okay.
He's had speakers in only on the proponent side.
Right.
Very well attended by all of the minions.
Right.
And so I don't know what his drive is. I don't know if he wants to be the next president of Harvard. I don't know if they're going to name the building after him. Who
right.
knows what
okay.
the deal
okay.
is.
All right, well, let me ask you, the substance of what he's been pursuing, is it just sort of a bully pulpit type of thing, or is there money involved?
Well, he had proposed $100 million to go to right. this research effort.
Right.
However, that is off the table at the moment. But I'm very certain of the fact that should this pass, which I predict it will,
right.
that in a few months' time or perhaps next year you'll see the money.
Okay, well now, what's the name of the bill and what does it do?
It's, well, the original bill was Senate 25.
Okay.
And what it does is the Senate version of the bill, which passed the Senate overwhelmingly, there were only two opposed.
Right.
It would pretty much give the scientists free rein to do whatever they wanted.
Right.
When the House debated it...
Well, when you say that, there's a whole range of do whatever they wanted.
Well,
that doesn't include human reproductive cloning, does it?
Well, they claim no.
Right.
But in fact, it's all semantic.
It is all semantic.
Because somatic cell nuclear transfer, as you know, is in fact cloning.
Yes.
But they say it's not.
So is there an explicit distinction in the... I'm glad we've finally reached the semantic point, which is largely what
it's
about.
Well, they call it
about,
therapeutic right? cloning, and they
right.
say therapeutic cloning is not the same as reproductive cloning. But I say,
right.
To use another term,
right.
sex is sex, whether it's therapeutic or otherwise, and so is cloning. I mean, there's no distinction. The same thing happens. It happens in a petri dish,
right.
and you keep the fertilized egg for a certain period of time, and then you kill it and harvest stem cells.
Right.
But in fact, it's all the same thing.
Let's go over that one more time so we can at least try to be clear on what is happening and how different people want to call the same thing different things. In somatic cell nuclear transfer, which is the transfer of the nucleus of a adult cell to take the place of the removed nucleus of a human egg. That's what that process is. That's what somatic cell.
That's exactly it.
And there's no dispute about among scientists that's what somatic cell nuclear transfer is. You take an egg, you take out the nucleus, you get a nucleus which has half the number of chromosomes necessary for life. You take a adult cell that has the full complement of chromosomes. You take the nucleus out of that, put it in the egg. Give it a little tickle with electricity, and it starts. If things are working, it starts to divide.
It becomes fertilized.
It becomes fertilized
and begins to divide
okay.
into several
right.
cells.
Right, yeah. And the process we've just talked about is called somatic cell nuclear transfer, and everybody agrees that that's what somatic cell nuclear transfer is, right?
Right.
Okay. Now we've got two terms of art here. One is therapeutic cloning, and one is reproductive cloning.
That's correct.
And what do people who how do people distinguish between those two things?
Well,
but both of those are somatic cell nuclear transfer.
That's correct.
Okay, now what's the difference between therapeutic and reproductive cloning?
Well, the proponents of stem cell research say that this is called therapeutic cloning.
Right.
And therefore, it's or they don't use the word cloning. They
right.
say therapeutic. This somatic cell is therapeutic.
Right.
But In fact, if you took an egg that was fertilized by somatic cell nuclear transfer,
right,
and you took another egg that was fertilized by a sperm,
right,
and you put them side by side,
right,
or even better, if they were implanted in utero,
right,
they would both grow to be full human beings.
Right. So the product of somatic cell nuclear transfer becomes reproductive cloning is when it's put into a uterus and allowed to grow.
Well, that's what they claim. They claim it has no potential as a human being because they are not going to implant it.
Right, but the only thing that keeps a therapeutically cloned cell from becoming a reproductively cloned cell is what happens to it after it's been cloned.
That's right.
So in other words,
once it's cloned,
right,
once that transfer takes place,
right,
it's cloned.
It's ready.
There's no more cloning that takes place.
Cloning's over. It's ready to go.
That's right.
And it's essentially, it's produced, and it's a clone, and it can go into depending on its fate after it's cloned, it can go in one of two directions. And tell us the direction it goes in to become, quote, therapeutic, and the direction it goes in to become, quote, reproductive.
Well, in the therapeutic manner,
right,
what they will do is allow it to grow up to, at this point in time anyway, up
right,
to 14 days.
Right.
At which point they will destroy it and harvest the stem cells.
Okay, that's
which
what
they will use for
right,
research purposes.
Okay, when it's at that point between like 3 to 14 days, it becomes a blastocyst, right?
Yes.
And the blastocyst has a shell which would become the placenta if it were reproducing.
Yes.
And the inside has a bunch of stuff called the cell mass.
Yes.
Right? And by cutting open the shell and grabbing the cell mass and putting it in a petri dish, those cells, which were called the cell mass when they were inside the blastocyst, now are called embryonic stem cells. Is that
yes,
right?
Yes.
Okay.
You're absolutely right.
Okay, that's the process of, and that's called therapeutic therapeutic cloning.
Well,
we call it
therapeutic cloning,
right,
certainly.
Okay. Now, if that's not if that embryo that's been created by the cloning process is implanted in a woman's uterus, then that's reproductive cloning, right?
Absolutely.
And everybody says that they're against reproductive cloning. Is that right?
Well,
or not everybody.
They do say that. Most everybody says that.
Right. Do you have suspicions?
But it makes one wonder,
right,
when you've had scientists say over and over again that it's exactly the same. It's
right,
exactly the same process. And were this therapeutically cloned egg allowed to go full term, it would in fact become a mini-me of whoever donated the adult cell.
Right. It would be genetically identical.
Yes.
Okay. So now, what does the legislation that's embodied in S-25 say about all this?
Well, it allows it to happen, and it supposedly forbids cloning, which,
right,
you know, in and of itself is a ridiculous statement.
Right.
And it pretty much, as I said, gives the scientists free reins. There's very little restriction put on anything. I mean, there's very little definitive in the original draft of the bill. The House has redrafted it and put restrictions on it. Things like allowing informed consent for women.
Right.
Allowing
or requiring?
Requiring,
right,
rather, I should say, requiring.
Right.
And many other restrictions. The process we're at right at this moment is there is a conference committee that's been formed between the House and the Senate,
right,
to iron out the differences.
Right, both houses have passed versions of this,
yes,
bill.
Yes, they have.
Okay, and so it's in conference now.
We're trying to come up with one version of the bill.
Right.
And it's pretty much been a very adversarial process. The Senate does not want to change its version of the bill.
And the Senate version It contains no requirements for informed consent on the
very unrestrictive in many ways.
Right.
And so this has been, you know, a battle going on for the last few weeks.
Right.
Now, I understand that the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate were actually going to get together today.
Okay.
To see if the between the two of them, if they can work this out.
Well, again, what are the disputes between the House for the
representatives? I can't give you all the specifics.
Okay.
Quite frankly, the conference committee is kind of a confidential thing.
Right.
And so those of us who are not involved really don't know the detail of the talks that are going on.
A little like the conclave in the Sistine Chapel here.
More or less.
Right.
Exactly.
and they're going to have little smoke coming up.
Once the smoke comes up, we'll know. Probably the Senate president won.
Okay.
So, you know, okay. We don't think this is the Speaker's battle, quite frankly. It's the President of the Senate's battle.
Okay.
The Speaker and he, however, want to have ongoing relations. So,
right.
You know, somehow they've got to come to terms with this.
Okay, so with all of this struggle going on within the legislature, what's the governor saying about
all
this?
The governor has clearly stated, he's gone a little bit to the left of President Bush. He has said that he is fully supportive of adult stem cell research,
right.
Which, in fact, I am as well.
Right.
The president has restricted experimentation on discarded eggs in vitro storage. The governor has said that he would go with that.
The president of the Senate?
No. Oh.
The president of the United States. Right. The president of the United States has said
there were certain stem cells lines available that he would allow them to use.
Yes. Right. But he's saying no new stem cell lines.
Exactly.
From existing, quote, discarded, end quote, embryos as a result of IVF.
Exactly.
And Governor Romney says
Governor Romney has said if they were discarded with parents' permission,
right.
You know, with provisos,
right.
That he would allow that. So
okay.
He's got a more lenient version.
Right.
A little more lenient than the president. But he will veto anything that allows somatic cell nuclear transfer.
Of what's called either therapeutic or reproductive.
Exactly.
So while the president says you can only use some existing stem cell lines, you can't make new ones from existing frozen embryos.
That's right.
Governor Romney says you could use those, but he says you can't make any new embryos through somatic cell nuclear transfer.
Absolutely.
Okay, but the president of the Senate says you can.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Oh yeah.
All right.
Absolutely.
So what's the count? Is the governor going to be able to veto this?
So
or not?
What we did here in the Massachusetts House, there are a number of conservative Democrats who feel that this is not the way to go, as much as the entire Republican caucus.
Right.
So we met kind of covertly for a couple of weeks leading up to the vote.
We, the Republican caucus and the conservative Democrats?
And the Democrats, on the House side only.
Right.
And, you know, the agreement was we were going to reach out to others that we felt might feel the same way we did in an effort to sustain the governor's veto when it came about, or better yet, vote it down the first time around.
And how many votes would you need to vote it down, and how many votes would you need to sustain
the
veto?
Well, we would need 53 votes, I think, is what we had decided we would need of the 160. So what is that, a third?
We need a third
to sustain.
Right.
So we were doing pretty well, quite frankly, and the Speaker had said all along that this was going to be a conscience vote. It was not going to be a leadership vote.
Right.
So a lot of the Democrats who in good conscience felt this was the wrong thing to do were with us.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, a day or two prior to the vote, it became a leadership vote.
Right, meaning,
and they peeled off here and there, and I believe we ended up with 37.
Which was pretty much the Republicans.
It was 21 of them were Republicans,
right.
And a few courageous Democrats.
Okay, and that was seen in the headlines as a veto-proof vote.
Exactly.
For the bill.
Yes.
Is that what it pretty much is like to be?
Well, if it remains that, yes. And, you know, interestingly enough, I had conversations along the way with several other legislators, and because I was only one of two females on board with this, you know, from my point of view, I kind of reached out to several of the other women on the issue that I wrote about.
Right, and that's what we're going to talk about now. Before we start talking about that, talk about what the gender disposition of the legislature there is.
Of the 200 legislatures, House and Senate, there are about 50 women.
Right. So that's about 25%. So
we're about a quarter.
Right.
In the House, I would say probably just maybe 41 or 2.
Okay.
Something like that.
All right. So let's now talk about what you talked about in this piece that you wrote about. So we're assuming then, if we sort of wrap up the politics of, at this stage, the bill is being negotiated now by the House and the Senate. It's going to go to the governor. If an agreement is reached, when will it be passed and sent to the governor?
Well, next week we're debating the budget. So unless they bring it in during the budget debate, one of those days, which is entirely possible. Anything is possible.
Right.
If not, I would say we would do it immediately following the budget.
So about the last week of April.
Yeah,
okay.
Probably.
And then if it passes,
it will go to the governor for his signature.
Right.
And of course, he has 10 days.
Right.
And depending upon what it says, he will either amend it and send it back, or he'll just plain veto it.
Can he amend it and send it back?
Yes, he can.
But then it has to be repassed, I imagine.
But if he amends it, you know, they'll just reject it.
Right.
And do what they want.
So what you're expecting is that he'll veto it.
He'll veto it. He absolutely will veto it.
And then the legislature will vote on that. And it needs to be a veto override needs to pass both houses?
Yes. Yeah.
And what do you think the likelihood of that is?
I think it's very unlikely.
Okay. So on the political side here, it's reasonable to assume that this bill is going to pass.
Yeah.
And become law. Now, your main concern about this is that in order to do the somatic cell nuclear transfer that we've been talking about, both on an experimental basis and should cures or treatments be developed on a therapeutic basis, will require a lot of human eggs, right?
Absolutely.
Now tell us about that. How many and what?
I will. And I want to start out by saying that that is not my only objection to this, but it is the part of it that I took on.
Could you briefly tick off the other objections, and then we're going to focus on...
I object to it in total. I mean, I think cloning is morally incorrect. I object to every single bit of it.
Okay.
But the piece that I took on to fight was the exploitation of women, which is another big part of it that no one speaks to.
Right.
And one of the things that troubles me greatly is the women legislators who have absolutely no regard for their sisters who are going to be exploited by this.
Okay, have you ever tried to raise the issue with them?
Oh, yes.
And what's been the reaction?
In conversation, some of the women have told me, we had a women's caucus meeting just prior to our first vote, and they were all going to stand up and fight this, and they were going to make this their signature issue.
Right.
And, you know, they were sick of being taken for granted and having the men devise this bill with only input from the women, and it went on and on and on.
Was this across party lines?
Yes, absolutely.
Right.
And then, of course, when the vote came, they were all, you know, in a different place.
Right.
But a couple of the women were going to offer an amendment to outlaw any drugs to be used in this process that were not FDA approved, which we know... that exists.
Or not FDA approved for that purpose.
For that purpose. So I went to them during the course of the debate and I said, you know, where is your amendment?
Right.
And they said, we're not going to offer it because it will kill the bill.
Right.
Well.
Okay. let's talk about a little bit about the medical or physiological aspect of all this. The only source of these eggs are the bodies of women. That's pretty much the case.
Yes, that is true.
Now.
That is the only source that is available to us at this time.
And in order to make it work, it's necessary to get, in general, a lot of eggs at one time from any particular woman,
yes.
Right? And what kind of drugs are used to make that happen?
Well, they use drugs to hyperovulate, cause the woman to hyperovulate,
right,
and produce many eggs.
Right.
And there are many drugs they use. I guess Lupron is the one that's most commonly known.
Now, a lot of the stuff we're talking about, I've discovered there's a whole field of called ART, Advanced Reproductive Technologies,
mm-hmm,
that are used in IVF or in vitro fertilization.
Yeah.
Which is apparently a huge industry with its own set of terms and financial arrangements and relations to all of the people who use its services. And it's also developed an advanced set of biomedical procedures to make that IVF happen.
And
that includes
these
hyperovulation
drugs. It is a whole industry unto itself.
Right.
And, you know, the women who have undergone these procedures thus far,
right,
are women who desperately want to conceive a child,
right,
and have been unable to do that.
Right.
And so they are willing to do almost anything,
right,
to have a baby in the end. And, of course, they're given all the warnings and admonitions and everything that goes with taking these drugs.
Right.
And they're perfectly willing to take the chance in order to have a baby.
If we wanted to simplify it and over dramatize a little bit, they're doing it for love, but we're talking now about doing it for money.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
All right. So, talk about the situation that you first about the numbers, about how many of these eggs you think are going to be necessary in order to do the research, and beyond that, how many eggs you think might be necessary to be used in treatments.
Well, when I talk about in the article, which was pretty much what I said on the floor of the House during debate when we were debating the bill,
right,
that in order to treat just one disease, they talk about curing many diseases, but the one I took for an example was diabetes.
Right.
And in order to treat 17 million diabetic patients in the United States, which it's estimated there are today,
right,
we would need at least 850 million eggs.
And why that ratio?
Because it takes many more than one egg for any success to be found.
Okay.
And in order to produce these 850 million eggs, it would take at least 85 million women.
All right.
Now, the other part of this that I think is interesting is there are 60 million women of reproductive age living in our country today.
Right.
And so, naturally, the biotech industry will have to go beyond the United States in order to harvest these eggs.
Right.
And the natural place for them to go would be to third world countries, to exploit the poor women of those countries, uneducated poor women. And, you know, I've been told over and over again there's not going to be any payment for this and so forth. Well, you know, we can only control what happens in our own state, if in fact we can do that.
Right.
But we certainly can't control what happens in other countries and in other places.
Now, the bills, to get back a little bit to the pending legislation, are there controls or restrictions or admonitions within that legislation that require some kind of informed consent,
yeah,
for these people?
In the House version, there is certainly an informed consent that is required, and most hopefully that will be in the compromise version.
And are there restrictions about paying women for the eggs?
Well, it's supposed to be pain and suffering, and
how much pain and suffering is involved here?
Well, exactly, and who's to determine?
Right.
And, you know, I took some of my information from what has happened in California.
Right.
And
tell us, we're in California. Tell us what's happened in California.
Well,
one
of the things I read in Proposition 71,
right,
which seeks to avoid exploitation,
right,
by limiting the payments for egg donations to the reimbursement for expenses.
Right.
But it doesn't define what qualifies for reimbursement. And some women have been paid as much as $50,000 to donate eggs.
Yes. On the page that I put up for this last version of the story that included a link to your article, the Google ads immediately popped up offering to buy eggs.
Yeah. So, you know, to me, it's going to be very much like young women have done in the past with young women and young men. In this case, we can't use both.
Right.
Have sold their blood or have sold, you know, people have sold their kidneys.
Right.
You know, they've done all kinds of things to raise money when you're in a vulnerable situation. And there's no reason to feel that this is not going to happen again.
Talk in more detail about some of the physiological risks involved in the hyperovulation drug regime.
Well, there are long-term risks and there are short-term risks. And, you know, we don't really know the extent of the long-term risks that could take place during this kind of procedure.
Because this procedure hasn't been going on for very long.
No, it hasn't. We really don't have any research. And
right.
The scientists will say that over and over again, that there is no way to determine at this point what will happen. The other thing is women are going to be donating more than one time. So they're going to be going through this procedure, taking these drugs more than once. And we have no research to, you know, tell any of these women what they're going to do. So the informed consent, to some degree, is foolhardy because you really can't provide the information. Some of the short-term risks are death, respiratory, cardiac arrest, brain damage, paraplegia, paralysis, loss of function of a limb, hemorrhage, allergic reaction, infection, bleeding, other injuries that could occur during retrieval that could require surgery to correct. Those are only some of the things that they know about, and I'm sure that there are others that we won't fully know for at least another two decades.
Okay. What about the reproductive future for themselves of the women who
have
undergone this?
Well, that's very much at risk also.
Okay.
I mean, no one can definitively guarantee them anything.
All right. So, as a result of this, what's your bottom line? What do you decide politically based on your understanding of the risks to women?
Well, I am not going to have it on my conscience that I have promoted such a devastating thing for other women, who, particularly those uneducated poor women who are vulnerable to this kind of victimization, will certainly not understand what they're getting into. And if I'm in a position to have a vote to prevent this kind of devastation, I certainly won't vote for it. I will not approve it. I have worked very hard to try and educate people as to this aspect of the SCNT that most people have never even thought of. You know, whenever they hear about it, they say to me, oh, gee, that's right. I never thought about where all these eggs would come from.
Okay, let me ask you about that. Has, in the public political discussion of this, in the legislature, in the media, and around the state, has the issue that you're trying to raise here about the need for all these eggs and the price that women are going to have to pay for it, for that to happen, are people aware of that and they're saying, well, that may be so, but the promise of treatments and cures is so great that we are willing to run that risk, or is the issue not even raised to that level yet?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. When I spoke on the floor of the House during debate, the other side never came back and refuted anything I said,
right?
Which I thought was very interesting,
right?
Because they have no refute for it.
Right.
They cannot refute it. And yet, the liberal press out our way, you know, just doesn't pick up on that kind of thing. So it was not highlighted in any of the press reports of that debate.
Right.
So I think it's both. I think it's a matter of people are not educated about it, and those who are pushing it and who are working on the other side of this issue poo-poo it and say it doesn't matter because the research and the cures that will be derived from this are worth, you know, anything we have to go through to get there. The interesting thing is we have no proof that there are going to be any cures. So we're willing to sacrifice all of these women for something we don't even know the result.
Let me ask about whether anyone has noted a particular irony here. From where I've been sitting, I've noticed that the main noise arising from Harvard Yard in recent months has been the discussion, the attacks on President Summers for saying that women aren't so good in science and math.
That's right. It's a dichotomy, isn't it?
Right, and the entire Harvard community, seems, especially the feminist sector, seems to have risen up in righteous indignation about the words that President Sumner said that alleged to indicate his feeling that women are inferior. How's that community reacting to your demand that women not be exploited all over the world through egg collection?
A lot of the very liberal feminists, in particular, someone by the name of Judy Nordstrom, who wrote the book Our Bodies, Ourselves,
right.
She's very much opposed to this, for this issue we've just been speaking about.
I'm sorry, what's her position?
She's the author of the well-known book, Our Bodies, Ourselves.
Yes, I know, but I mean, what's her position on
this?
Oh, her
position is she's against it because of the exploitation of women issue that we've just been speaking about.
Right.
And so she has been begging to come in and speak to legislators so she could educate them.
Right.
And I worked very hard to try and get her to the Women's Caucus to agree to hear her speak.
Right.
Well, they wouldn't agree to let her in to the caucus meeting. However, they did agree to have her come and speak to them after a Democratic caucus later the same day.
Right.
The Democratic caucus was, of course, to promote this bill.
Right.
She did come in and speak to whoever remained behind to hear, but it doesn't seem to have made any impression, even on the women that I know stayed to hear. They feel as though the informed consent thing is all they need to do.
Okay.
But, in fact, it's political is what it is. It doesn't have anything to do with whether or not they feel the women are protected. It has to do with following the leader, and that's what they're doing. It's strictly political.
Here in California, a lot of the politics that propelled Prop 71 to a victory was the desire to stick a sharp stick in the eye of President Bush.
And I think that is part of it here as well. Aside from the fact they want to stick a sharp stick in the eye of Governor Romney.
Right.
As you might have heard, he's been mentioned several times for the national stage, and whether or not that happens remains to be seen, but they certainly don't want him to go on to bigger and greater things.
Well, now, speaking of the national stage, I was trying to track down Senator Sam Brownback of Kansas, who has a bill in the U.S. Senate to prohibit all kinds of human cloning. He was apparently at Harvard last Friday or Saturday, and he gave a big address there at the law school or some part of the law school attacking cloning. Of any form. Do you know how that figures in?
I wish I did.
But apparently everyone's converging there in the Boston area to push for or against cloning. It's like
and the major forces are to push for it. All the political forces are to push for it.
Right.
And Governor Romney, you know, try as he will, with only 21 House members and 6 Senate members, I mean, there just are not enough of us to make this happen.
So what else are you trying to do now, or what ways do you think you might be able to use to get your message out besides talking to us?
I'm just trying to take every opportunity to speak publicly about the issue and to educate people and have them, you know, I mean, I'm waiting for the public outrage, quite frankly. When are the people going to stand up and make their voices heard?
Okay, well, you've made your voice heard, and I'm going to put this on the internet in a few minutes, and everyone else will be able to hear you.
Let's hope it helps. I hope people read it and listen and understand that this is probably one of the most pivotal things that we're doing in our society at this point in time.
Okay, don't hang up, but I want to thank you for talking to us on California Politics today and expressing your point of view on this important part of the stem cell issue.
Thank you.
Thank you.